Hi, I'm Eric Nakamura, and we're at Lisa Ling's house for this podcast.
Hi. Hi, giant robot. What's up?
So, I guess one of the questions I wanted to ask or start off with was your show, the new show. Well, it's not that new now.
It's over. Third season.
Is it third? I thought it was second.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, third season.
Our America?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I listened to some, or I've listened. I guess I've watched some. And then I realized Our America is a little bit scary.
It can be a little scary. What we try to do is provide viewers with sort of the good, the bad, and the ugly of being an American. And I think that it's very reflective of the American experience. And we explore subcultures and worlds that you may have heard about but never delved too deeply into. The most recent episode was about nuns in America, and we followed a couple of nuns from different orders, and it was a really beautiful piece about this extreme decision that some women make. Now, the number of young women entering the convent has been declining rapidly, but for those who are going in, they're actually choosing to live the more conservative lifestyle and to wear the habit or the wedding dress to Jesus, as they refer to it as. And it's kind of interesting because we live in this culture now where women are under so much pressure. We can never be skinny enough. We can never be pretty enough. And these women, in a way, they liberate themselves from all of that. And they take the vow of chastity, of obedience, and of poverty. And their sole purpose in life is to pray for people and honor their husband, Allah, Jesus Christ.
I know a Buddhist nun.
Yeah.
Who lives, she's Vietnamese, lives in South France, I guess. There's like a lot of different headquarters. And same thing. I interviewed her and actually heard her story. Actually, then she wouldn't let me publish it or run it. I don't know why. She just said it was really odd. But yeah, she was talking about how her life changed. She went from like things like, you know, jealousy, raging jealousy and things like that, to like having to drop all of that. And just an interesting kind of lifestyle change.
Yeah, it's a really extreme decision.
So not all your stories are scary.
Not all.
But I always think that there's something strange about them.
I think they're worlds that you don't hear about every day. You know, we also explore the lives of people who are on the sex offender registry. You know,
that's
people
scary.
Who
live in tents. Yeah.
Yeah. Some live in tents. I mean, it's definitely an intense story in that we have over 700,000 Americans who are on the sex offender registry. And so we pose the question, well, do all those people who are on the registry really deserve to be there? For me, people who offend against children are the most vile, you know, human beings on earth, and they deserve the most severe punishment. But there are people who, men who are 17 years old dating a 14-year-old, they turn 18 and they're all of a sudden
a criminal.
Yeah, and then labeled a sex offender for the rest of their life. So we try to break things down to the extent that we can.
How much of your own politics can get into a show or a single episode? Is that like limited? Is that kind of, or do you have free reign?
I try to be really careful about inserting my political views on in my stories, but I definitely get emotional sometimes. I mean, I worked on a story about child trafficking, and there was a girl, 18-year-old girl, who told me that she would call the police. She was like 14 years old. She would call the police and beg them to arrest her so she could have a safe place to sleep at night. And I just lost it when I was hearing the story. I couldn't even imagine how a young girl would have to call the police to seek refuge. I mean, it just, to me, like the worst in humanity has really kind of displayed itself to me, and sometimes it's really hard to deal with.
And then, but are you allowed to, is there limits by the network for yourself in that case? Are they saying, hey, be more impartial, be more middle,
No.
Be more conservative? Or do they say anything like that?
No, own the Oprah Winfrey Network. They've been so permissive of letting me sort of do what I want to do. I mean, this is the most creative control I've ever had in a job. And when you watch my shows, I actually think that you might be a little challenged to figure out where I stand on you know, the various issues that we cover, unlike a lot of news organizations now that are all about opinion. You know, these days, the highest rated shows on our news networks consist of these guys who are yelling at you and telling you what to think. And it's so overt, and how they call themselves news to me is unconscionable. For me, what I try to do is be the vehicle through which people can experience these worlds and these stories. And I try my hardest to be as objective and non-judgmental as I can. And I hope that people watch my shows with a sense of compassion and open-mindedness.
But you are using your own lens because I guess you're kind of narrating throughout the show.
Yeah.
How do you know? Well, let's see, I don't want to say how do you know. I guess it's all done post, I assume. But when you're, I guess, putting together the episode, you know, who's writing that? And like, when are you doing that kind of inserting your own text or words? Because sometimes it looks like your interviews are happening on the spot and then they're inserted. So that looks live, or I mean, as if it's live, but...
My interviews are not dissimilar from what we're doing right now. We're just having a casual conversation. Very rarely do I write down interview questions, because to me, what I try to do is just have a conversation. I mean, I happen to be an intrinsically curious person.
Sure.
So I find everybody that we encounter just fascinating, and I really believe that most people have a story to tell, and most people want to be heard. And I work with the producers and the writers on the final script. But we really do try to allow the people that we interview, you know, our subjects, to kind of dictate how the story is going to unfold.
So what happens when a story doesn't end up interesting? What happens?
I guess we've been lucky, Eric. It's kind of crazy because we're in our third season. We're already shooting our fourth. And... I've never been prouder of any work that I've ever done. Like, each episode takes you into these worlds. I think they're the most beautifully shot shows on TV. They're in contrast to everything else that's on TV, which is loud and sensational and exploitative. My shows are really slow and introspective. And I can't believe that we've been able to produce as many really beautiful shows as we have. But somehow I really think that people are hungry for that. Like, I think that at a certain point, we've reached, like, saturation point with, like, obnoxious, sensational programming. And I think I hope people appreciate this kind of more pensive, introspective storytelling. That's my hope, at least.
That's cool. I like it, too. So then how do you, like, combat, I guess, the new wave of, I suppose you can call it, like, internet journalism, internet kind of...
Yeah.
You know, the new 18-year-old kid who's going to try to do a news story now and try to do it his own way. Is there, like, any kind of, like, are you looking at that as, like, oh, that might one day be my competition? That might be the future one day. I'm going to have to, A, maybe do shorter stories that are faster.
Yeah.
Is that ever, like, in the back of your mind?
No, I think it's awesome. Uh-huh. I think that the internet is so empowering and is allowing natural storytellers or people who have a gift of storytelling to have a platform. Now, I think that a lot of what's on the internet is erroneous and not fact-checked, and I think that's a problem. Like,
sure.
I've seen so much stuff up on the web that is just blatantly untrue. But by the same token, I think that people who have stories to tell, people who are aspiring journalists, have the opportunity to write stories or shoot and produce stories and have them seen in a way that they have never been able to do so before. So I actually think that this really interesting sort of democratization of journalism is happening, and I think that's really positive, as long as people take seriously facts and don't kind of produce erroneous stuff, because I think that can be really dangerous.
When is it kind of dangerous for you guys, though, to get involved in doing a show and then actually somewhat guiding it? You know, is that kind of a worry for you guys that, you know, something might happen? Like, you went with the sex offender guy,
mm-hmm.
went to his mom's house. I'm not saying you told him to go to his mom's house, but you went with him to his mom, or you saw him go there or something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you would have said, hey, let's go to the beach, you would have taken him into danger zone, right?
Yeah.
And he might not have even realized it. He'd been like, yeah, let's go to the beach. You know what I mean? Like, when does the...
Yeah.
You know, when do you guys kind of worry about that kind of stuff, the lies?
Well, we try to let our interviewees, our subjects, take us. and we don't want to cross any lines. I mean, we take very seriously their concerns, and definitely there have been times where we've screwed up, like, you know, this sex offender who was wearing an ankle bracelet. He wasn't supposed to go to the beach. And we said, oh, we should go to the beach. And we didn't know that was not...
Oh, you guys suggested it?
Yeah, we suggested that.
He wanted
to go to the beach. And okay. So we said, yeah, let's go.
Sure.
And his ankle monitor went off. Now, his ankle monitor went off another time because he went home when he wasn't supposed to go home. So it wasn't just the infraction at the beach, fortunately for us. Mm-hmm. But he ended up going back to jail.
Sure.
So there's a big responsibility. And that's one of the reasons why I really tried to stay in touch with a lot of the people we've interviewed, mm-hmm. because they come to trust us and tell us things that sometimes they don't even tell their closest friends or family members. And I really feel an obligation to try and maintain contact with them and prove to them that we're not just in it to get their story and you'll never hear from us again.
Right. I noticed too, some episodes you go back, I guess this tells me that you're shooting next season now. You go back 5 months later, 4 months later, you're visiting them way later to do a follow-up. Do you always do a follow-up, or is that just occasionally when it needs one or something unfolds? You know?
We've definitely done follow-ups for the last two seasons, the first two seasons. I'm not sure we're going to do one this season. It depends on what happens in people's lives. I mean, if some sort of drastic things happen that need updating, we will consider it. But as of now, nothing's planned. But I love doing the updates because, again, a lot of these people really, because they're real people telling us their real stories, I think people get invested and they want to know what's happening. They want to know if this guy got a job or if he's still living in a tent or, you know, if these, you know, little girls in beauty pageants have reconsidered their decision to be part of the pageant world. I mean, I think because they're real people want to know what kind of progress they've made.
How did you pick the title, Our America? Or did you pick the title?
So I did pick the title. Initially, when OWN asked me to do a series for their network, the original title was going to be Inside with Lisa Ling. And when we started shooting the episodes, I thought, you know what? Let's take ownership of all of these cultures and stories and people. You know, no matter how challenging the story is, no matter how difficult, no matter what kind of profile these people have, they are Americans. They were born of mothers who loved them and are human beings. And let's take ownership of all that exists in America, whether it is challenging, or disturbing or moving and enlightening. And, you know, for me, as an Asian American who was teased my whole upbringing and really, like, you know, embarrassed of being Chinese American. I mean, I was one of the few in my neighborhood. I never liked my friends to come over because my house always smelled like Chinese food and people would tease me for my hair smelling like Chinese food.
What's wrong with these people?
I know.
It's like,
now I wish I my house smelled more like Chinese food, but I don't cook anything. But, to be able to host a series called Our America just means so much to me.
You know, I
never thought I would front something called Our America just because I never felt like an American growing up.
It kind of has a title, though. It's like almost epic in a way. Like, it's one of those titles that it can be a show that goes for 30 years and, you know, people are going to know. You know, it's kind of like almost a 2020. It's as strong as any kind of a name, but Our America, it almost carries a responsibility to it.
Yeah, there's no shortage of stories, that's for sure. There's no shortage of characters. And for me, I guess, you know, and you may have had a similar experience where you grow up, you know, I never felt totally American because I had this Asian face, but yet I didn't feel Chinese because I didn't know the first thing about being Chinese from China. Like, being Asian American is a totally distinctive, you know, category altogether. And so it's been such an incredible, even though much of my career has been spent overseas reporting, hosting and executive producing Our America has been in many ways the greatest honor of my career.
Isn't that kind of odd though? When you think about it, Our America, a show called Our America, and it's hosted by an Asian American.
Yeah.
That's a little bit interesting to me.
Yeah. I think it's awesome. I think it's totally awesome because I feel totally American. I'm an Asian American, but
sure.
I, you know, I'm as American as anyone else. It's so funny. I was on the Kathy Griffin show yesterday with Jane Fonda and Sharon Osbourne, and someone and she said, "What's the worst thing anyone's ever said to you, like in an email or letter?" And I said, "Go back to China." And the reason why I was so upset by that was because I'm from Sacramento, California. You know, it's like, hello, you idiots. You know, but no matter how confident you are, when people say shit like that, like it never ceases to hit you at the core. You know, it's like it further draws a distinction between you and the rest of America, and that's hurtful to me.
Yeah, I guess that'll always kind of continue somewhere, you know, little by little, but yeah, hopefully less and less with the internet, maybe. I don't know.
I hope so. I mean, I'm sure you probably get people saying, like, where are you from?
Oh,
like,
all the time.
Sacramento?
Yeah.
No, where are you really from? I'm like, fucking Sacramento, okay?
And they're like, no.
Yeah, exactly.
They just can't get it. Where are your parents from? San Luis Obispo?
Yeah. Right. Like, what part of Japan is that in?
Central California is where he's from, where he's born. But yeah, that's kind of how it works.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. So I guess before you joined Oprah's network, you were doing National Geographic, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Maybe there's probably other things in between. But I always feel like you're kind of like this, almost a freelance journalist, but not quite. Just because it seems like you've gone through different kind of, I guess, styles of work. Right.
Yeah, no, I haven't had an office at a you know, in an office building in a very long time, and I've been lucky that I've been able to work for reputable organizations that have hired me to host series or produce episodes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're on The View, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so the weird transition I thought, which is kind of exciting to me when I heard it, was that you left The View and went to National Geographic,
yeah.
Right? That transition seemed like this 180-degree swing. It's like, oh, I want to leave this, like, daytime TV to go do something that's, like, could be hardcore news. You know, you could be interviewing Connie for all I know, right?
Right.
It's kind of like this big change. What kind of made you want to do that?
Yeah, no, it's true. I went from interviewing, like, Tom Cruise and Penelope Cruz and so on to interviewing Colombian rebel soldiers in the jungles. Well, I come from a journalism background. A lot of people don't realize it. Before I went to The View, I was a reporter for a show called Channel 1 News that was seen in schools. You know, Eric, that's when I met you. I was doing Channel 1.
And that's a channel that, for people my age, we didn't have TVs in class, right?
Right.
So
it was a show that was seen in middle schools and high schools across the country. In fact, Anderson Cooper, with whom everyone is familiar, who's on CNN, was one of my colleagues, and we were a bunch of kids in our early 20s. I mean, I started there when I was 18, who were being sent all over the world to cover stories. So I was covering the Civil War in Afghanistan when I was 21, the Civil War in Algeria when I was 22. I spent time in Iran, in Iraq, in China, Cambodia, all in my early 20s. But after 7 years of doing Channel 1, it was time to get a job in the adult world. And I wasn't ready to go to the news, like network news, because I knew that I'd be one of the youngest reporters and I'd be resigned to covering, like, you know, a lot of the more local stories and so on. So I found out about auditions at The View, and somehow I got selected to host the show. And I had a lot of fun doing it, and it was really... like, it was an amazing life, you know. I was living in New York. I'm a kid from Sacramento, living in New York, invited to every party in, you know, in the city, and, you know, was sent, like, every designer, you know, every designer wanted me to wear their clothes on the show because we were on every single day. Like, it was an incredible experience, but I was 26 years old, and I had to be in the studio every single day faking interest in a lot of celebrities' movies that were completely moronic and stupid. Now, sometimes it was really fun, and I genuinely enjoyed, you know, chatting with celebrities about their lives and their work, but for the most part, I felt like I was being pretty disingenuous because I was having to pretend that everything was so great, that these celebrities were, like, so fascinating. And so I decided to leave. I still wanted to be out in the field and traveling in the world. And I knew at that age, if I didn't break off and do it then, I might not get an opportunity to do it again later. So I left The View when I was like 28 or 29 and started at National Geographic. And within a few months, I was reporting in China and Colombia and Bolivia. And it was awesome.
So when you're going back, I guess, doing, I guess, news stories, how much danger are you really in, you know, the hard news when you were actually, maybe the more Nat Geo stuff versus...
And the Channel One stuff versus the stuff I'm doing now.
Yeah.
There were definitely moments where we found ourselves in perilous situations. You know, when we were with the Colombian anti-narcotics police busting cocaine laboratories in the jungle, that was definitely an insecure environment. Or, you know, anywhere in Colombia that we visited, when I would go to the front lines of various civil wars. But, you know, for me, I would look at the experience as going in for a couple of weeks and then being able to go home. You know, the people who live under those circumstances have to do so every day of their lives. So if I could go in and kind of get a sense of what it was like and communicate that to an audience, that's what I really tried to do. You know, we always took security seriously. But as a journalist, you never know what could happen. And you hire fixers when you're overseas who you trust to take you where you need to go, fixers who have worked with journalists before.
When I watch a lot of, you know, television that's, I guess, journalist related, especially news, war, stuff like that, it seems like the bigger the star, the more protected they are.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I get it. So it seems like they're not in danger at all. It seems like they're as safe as can be. I've heard stories about how helicopters fly in and, you know, it seems very safe, but I'm wondering if you're on a lower budget kind of a network.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Are you like a little more in harm's way?
Well, most of my career was spent with like a ragtag.
Sure. That's what I was kind of getting at. I was thinking maybe.
Laura, you just open the door and.
It's okay.
I'll just start that. Most of my career was spent with like a ragtag crew, and we would go in with 3 or 4 people max. And I liked it that way because we could be more mobile. And if we had to get out of a situation, we could do so pretty easily. You know, when I started doing Planet Peril for CNN and we went in with the MEND, the rebel movement in Nigeria, they hired security. And when I would travel with the Oprah show to the Congo, for example, they would hire security. So it's true. I think the more sort of high-profile show that you work for, the more they insist on security. But those journalists who are out there, those young journalists who are really, really out there because they truly believe in what they're doing and they believe the importance of telling these stories, there's considerable risk. Yeah. And it's important that they take those risks into consideration and do a full risk assessment. I mean, you know, when my sister was captured in North Korea, she was working for Current TV and they were a small crew, but they hired a fixer like most journalists do, who had worked with TV crews before. But when you're out there, we probably put too much trust in these fixers, and anything can happen, whether you have security or you don't.
Yeah, I mean, after reading her story, I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
I can't trust the fixer.
No, it's true. It's true. And there's reason to believe that fixer was on the take.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
You just don't know, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess you'll never know, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then, when your episodes air, like on a Tuesday, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tuesday. What are you doing when it is?
I try to be home. You know, I love watching the episodes with my husband. I don't let him watch them until they air. And he's kind of like this guy's guy football watching, you know, jock.
Sure.
And so, I think that his palette or his TV watching is very reflective of mainstream America. And so when I see him really responding to the shows, like, he really loved the show that we did on child beauty pageants. And we just watched the show that I did about nuns, and he loved them. And it proves to me that people are interested in storytelling that is a little bit slower and more introspective, you know. Paul is the first to, like, you know, he watches sports because it's so fast-paced. He watches, like, all these cooking shows that are loud and kind of, you know, obnoxious, but he really gets into the show. So I like to watch them home with him or with family.
What does he do, especially if you're going and doing a harder news assignment, but you're gone for, I don't know, how long would you be gone for? A week, maybe?
Yeah, I'm generally gone for about a week to 2 weeks.
Could be longer. Then you come back and you might have to go again.
Yeah. It's hard.
What's he doing? Or how's that work? Because I always feel like you know, either you're a nomadic journalist. I see some journalists, I'm like, that guy's probably not married. Yeah. You know, a lot of them that are in Afghanistan, I'm like, still there 3 years later? You're not married, right? There's no way you have like a family. How do you go about doing it? Because it's kind of, you know, you have a home.
I think in the past I felt
like you're more nomadic. You're willing to do it. You know, like how punk rock can you be these days?
It's very hard. In the past, if you would have told me, okay, I need you to stay in India for another month, I was like, no problem. Like, I loved it. I'm 38 years old now, and I still love it. Like, I love whether I'm in, you know, Podunk, Ohio, or West Virginia, or I'm in Hong Kong. Like, I love being in the field. But when you're married, you know, you need to be responsible. And it's been very, very hard. I'll be honest. Like, if you want to pursue this kind of journalism or travel a lot and be on the road, you need to really, really take into consideration whether you want or whether you should be married. You know, Paul and I have weathered a lot of storms. It's been really, really tough. And even though he knew what my life was like going into our marriage, when we finally got married, I don't think he realized how difficult it would be. But he's been incredibly supportive, and I need to do a better job of making my marriage and my home life a priority, because I haven't done it well enough in the past couple of years. I'm lucky I have a supportive husband who has fortunately made friends here in LA and has his family here, but it definitely is not the kind of job that you should have if you want to have a really stable marriage. It's really hard.
So what's your future in that then? I mean, are you going to keep doing this show where you have to keep leaving? I mean, is that like something that's even up for consideration, or do you want to keep doing this for the next infinite?
I definitely need to slow it down a little bit. Mm-hmm. I still want to continue doing this kind of work. I just don't know that I can do as many. I mean, I've shot already 22 episodes in the last couple of years. You know, each hour is an original hour of programming that's immersive, and that's a lot of time on the road.
Sure, it could be like a movie, right? Making a movie each
episode.
Nobody,
if you think about it, Eric, nobody does an original documentary every single week that has someone really deeply involved.
True.
In the history of television, I don't think anyone has ever done it.
They're usually 10 minutes each, right?
Or yes. Segment, right? Yeah. So it's a hugely laborious process that I've loved, but I need to slow it down. And I'm working on some scripted projects right now that I'm really excited about. I'm working on a project with the executive producer of The Killing and Gael Garcia Bernal and Diego Luna, who are like such amazing, hottie little Mexican guys. So I think that there are a lot of ways to tell really substantive and provocative programming that aren't just in the nonfiction realm, obviously, for me.
So you're a Chinese-American, right? So how is it like, I guess, in your job position, you know, it's a position that's a little different than everybody else's, but there's this huge run of female Asian journalists, right, on television. Do you consider yourself part of a group like that, or are you kind of just doing your own thing? Because it seems a little different, but at the same time, it's an Asian woman with a microphone who's got control of the TV.
Yeah, right? I definitely I consider what I do pretty different, and it's because I'm really lucky. I mean, I think a lot of journalists would like to do this kind of work.
Sure, but most are in studio, right?
Yeah. And you know, I hate wearing makeup. I hate being in a studio. You know, I when I have to do studio work, I have to remove makeup immediately.
Oh, is this Paul's helicopter?
I know. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's our little chopper on our rooftop air pad. No. But I've gotten such support from Asian female journalists. You know, I worshipped Connie Chung when I was growing up. And when I started at The View, I got cards and flowers from a lot of different high-profile people. But the one that I kept on my corkboard was the one from Connie Chung. And she's been such a mother figure to me ever since. Linda Yu, who's a staple of Chicago news, has also become such a mentor of mine. So I feel so lucky to have these incredible Asian women in my life. So is my work similar to theirs? Not necessarily, but I have derived such inspiration from a lot of these women.
What was up with Connie Chung's retirement piano song?
I know.
What was that?
You know, it's kind of a shame because...
It was kind of like funny, but I was like, what?
Yeah,
what
it was weird. See, Connie is kooky. People okay. don't realize
okay, then that's
that Connie
cool.
is like a crazy, hilarious, funny woman, but people have pigeonholed her in such a way that when she does do things that are a little quirky, it comes off as... I don't know, what's the word? Like, just bizarre, right?
Sure.
Like, what in the hell is she doing?
But oh,
like,
so, okay.
That's totally her.
Oh, okay, then that's cool.
Like, she's...
That was a little weird. I'm like, oh, this is really odd. I did not expect this. Okay.
I know.
That's even better then.
But
no,
I
that's
think,
cool.
But I think it's because people don't expect her, but she is one of the funniest women I know.
Awesome.
Like, she has had me, like, I feed my pants laughing from you know, being with her, but people just aren't used to it. To seeing her, and I wish she would, because I think people are used to seeing Asian women like be serious all the time. When I did Kathy Griffin, like I love the opportunity to be funny, because I think people see me in such a serious light that it surprises people when I, you know, crack jokes and you know, even cuss. Sorry for the background noise.
That's
my
okay.
little niece
That's
in the background.
Cool. So I'll say what's upcoming in this season? What do we get to watch? Or even next season? Do we get any kind of like lead into what happens?
Well, this season we have an incredible show on arranged marriages among people who are living in America. We have a piece about a guy who's been living on the sex offender registry. We do a piece about Americans who are living beneath the poverty line for the very first time in their lives. A show that's upcoming about teen moms. You know, the rate of teen pregnancy is at its lowest level in 40 years, but we still have a higher rate of teen pregnancy than anywhere else in the Western
world. Are these all middle America stories? Some of these sound like stuff that I would have watched on Jerry Springer, maybe, but...
Really?
You know, well, I'm not saying that bad. That's
no, Jerry Springer's like,
that was,
you know,
scripted,
I'm sleeping with my brothers.
But I mean, I feel like I'm hearing stories that are... I'm picturing Appalachia or something like that. You know, the arranged marriage, that can't be like Los Angeles.
Oh yeah. We spent time with a girl in Los Angeles, in New York, in Chicago, in Brooklyn.
Okay, the poverty line thing, was that also in a big city, or is that like
Chicago? And we spent time in one of the richest suburbs in America, Lake Bluff, Illinois, and people who are having to seek out their food pantry.
Okay, because you described it, I keep picturing middle America in the middle of like a trailer in the middle of nowhere.
No, we're talking
big city.
Yeah, truly people who had six-figure incomes who are now living beneath the poverty line for the first time. So yeah, we run the gamut.
That's America then.
Yeah.
That really is America. I kept thinking, God, maybe our America on this your show is going to be centered on like these faraway places.
No,
you
know? We're all over the place.
Cool.
To my husband's chagrin, but and then the next season, I'm not supposed to talk about what we're working on, but I will tell you that we've already started production on three shows, and it's been fascinating. And they're shows that I've been wanting to do for a long time. And you know, the other thing that I'm so proud of with our America is our DPs, the people who, you know, are shooting the show. They're truly, every single person is so passionate, and they're such artists. And I think that our camera work is the most beautiful on television. I really do.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah. All right. Well, I guess that's cool for right now.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's fun.
All right, cool. Well, thanks for listening. I'm Eric Nakamura with Lisa Ling.
Thank you.
Thanks. Oh, and tune into Our America.
Tuesday nights at 10.
Yeah. And I guess you have to check your local cable provider for the channel.
Go to own.tv for the own channel finder.
Or watch a hack version on YouTube.
If they exist.